Thank you and welcome, and thanks for joining us for this year's Hatfield Address. It's a great honor and pleasure to welcome Cornell's 31st Hatfield Fellow, Eric Schmidt, one of the most innovative and successful technology leaders in the world. For three decades, the Robert S. Hatfield Fund for Economic Education has brought the most influential corporate leaders to Cornell to serve as Hatfield Fellows. The fund, established in 1980 by the Continental Group Foundation, honors the late Robert S. Hatfield, who was a Cornell trustee, member of the great class of 1937, and former president, chair, and CEO of the Continental Group. Selection as a Hatfield Fellow is the highest distinction Cornell can bestow on corporate leaders. And the Hatfield Address, our premier annual corporate event, is intended to serve as a major platform for the exchange of ideas between the academic and corporate communities. Our speaker today has played a truly crucial role leading a company that obviously has transformed the ways we find information, making more information available to more people faster than ever before. Google was founded by Larry Page and Sergey Brin in 1998 with a $1 million stake from venture capitalists. Last year, the company reported $38 billion in revenue, and it receives a staggering total of 1 billion unique visitors per month. And in case you're wondering, more than my speech page. It is, of course, the world's most popular search engine, but in addition to locating text-based information, countless people around the world also use it to find images and videos and translate texts and shop and read news and define words and much more. It has even altered the English language. In 2006, the Oxford English Dictionary officially added the verb Google. Google has implications, of course, far beyond the ease of locating information and images. Ken Auletta, author of Google, The End of the World as We Know It, argues that Google has ushered us into the dawn of a new digital democracy that grants more power to individuals. He also calls the company a profound disruptor of the existing order, reminding us that repressive regimes in some part of the world have attempted to censor Google and block their citizens' access to it. Here at Cornell, we have noted another characteristic of Google: enormous generosity. As we develop our New York City Tech campus on Roosevelt Island, Google has provided us with office space in the heart of Manhattan. This is an enormous help as we undertake the new venture, and we're very, very grateful to Google. Eric Schmidt joined Google as CEO in 2001. He came to the position with training in engineering, a bachelor's degree from Princeton, as well as computer science, a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. Before joining Google, he had been chair and CEO of Novell and chief technology officer at Sun Microsystems. Dr. Schmidt has played a vital role in Google's growth, bridging the world of the idea-driven founders with a pragmatic world of business. He has helped Larry and Sergey further sharpen their vision of a company completely focused on users and dedicated to making all the information in the world accessible. And he has helped them stay true to that vision through the incredible growth of the last decade. One of Dr. Schmidt's many innovations is the 70-20-10 model. Google employees are encouraged to spend 70% of their work time on core tasks, 20% on related projects, and 10% on being creative with new projects unrelated to the core business. This has proved to be an extremely productive model for the company and for the workers. Last year, Dr. Schmidt stepped down as CEO to become executive chair of Google, taking responsibility for partnerships and other business relationships, government outreach, and technology thought leadership. Dr. Schmidt's expertise is highly regarded in government, industry, and academia. He has been appointed to President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, as well as the Prime Minister's Advisory Council in the UK. He has been elected to the National Academy of Engineering and is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He also chairs the board of the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan Public Policy Institute and is a trustee of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey. And as we announced yesterday, and I'm just thrilled about this, he has agreed to join Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Dr. Irwin Jacobs as part of a steering committee for Cornell NYC Tech, giving us directly the immensely valuable guidance of three of the world's great tech entrepreneurs. As one of this country's premier corporate leaders, Eric Schmidt, in my estimation, is an ideal Hatfield Fellow, and I'm delighted that he is here in that role today. I greatly appreciate, Eric, you sharing your time and knowledge with us. Please join me in welcoming the 2012 Hatfield Lecturer, Eric Schmidt.
It's a really big deal for me to be here. It's an honor to receive this award. But to me, the most fun thing is that David, Kent, Dan, my friends here at Cornell, won in a competition to go change the world in a project in New York that I think will have impact at the level that Cornell should be having. I think it's extraordinary what the opportunities are before us as we start literally this year. And I think over the next 10 or 20 years, you're only going to hear good things of the decisions that were made by this leadership team now to try to make innovation, wealth creation, solve real problems, and really solve a problem of creating true entrepreneurship in New York City. I think it's extraordinary. So let me start by asking you all a question. How many of you have used Google in the last 24 to 48 hours? Maybe I should have asked the other side of the question. Okay, good answer. Okay, next question. How many of you feel absolutely confident that you'll have a job where you want, when you want, working for the place that you want, maybe 6 months after graduation? Maybe 15%, okay. Another question. Do you think that the world will be a better place 5 years from now than it is today? Who thinks so? Okay. Maybe half. For those of you who said that it's not going to be your choice and a better place, I'm glad I'm here. I hope I'm the bearer of good news, and I've got some good news. I think that you're wrong. I think the world is going to be a better place much sooner than you think. I think there's plenty of room for optimism, and my goal today is to talk about what those opportunities are, and I actually think it's because of you, right? It's hard to understand that. It's you. You've grown up in it. You take it for granted that you're the network generation. You're going to define who our new networked age is, right? By scale, by mass. You're connected to each other in ways those of us who came before could never even dream of. And you're using those connections to strengthen the invisible ties that hold humanity together and that deepen our understanding of all the world around us. And in the past, it's always older generations standing up on high, trying to teach the next generation the ways of the world, trying to make sure you follow their footsteps. It's different now. You're teaching us. This generation, your generation, is the first fully connected generation the world has ever known. What's the first thing that you do when you get up in the morning? Check your phone. Your laptop, read some email, comb through your social networks, see if you have to get out of bed. Right? I claim that if you are awake, you're online. By the way, that's the definition of connectivity. And you're probably texting your friends right now, tweeting this speech, changing your status. Smile, you're on camera. It's okay. So there's this joke about the college kid, you know, getting mugged who says, hold on. Let me update my status, letting my friends know that I'm being mugged, and then you can have my phone. You think I'm making that up? Happens all the time. But it's a telling, and I think it's a stark depiction of how essential technology has come to your generation's identity and your ability to connect to the world. And identity and connection are concepts as old as humanity itself. And they make up so much of who we are. They shape our times. They define a human condition. Identity and connection. It's your task to take those time-worn concepts, spin them around, right? Reimagine them and make them fresh and new and exciting. You have an advantage, by the way. You have an innate mastery of technology, an ability to find and foster connections that nobody before. And I can say from my position, we are jealous. We're jealous of what that means to the way you're wired, to the opportunities that will happen to you for many decades ahead of you. And it's interesting that people bemoan a generation who grew up living a life in front of screens, always connected to something or someone. These people are wrong, right? The fact that we are now connected is a blessing, not a curse, and that we can solve many, many problems in the world as a result. Not only is it an advantage that you have, it's also a responsibility that you carry. Now let's talk about how the world is changing. I would argue that networks are changing our world. There's good examples. There's increasing returns to education. I'm really glad you decided to come here. There's increasing returns to global brands. That's why American firms with brands like Google and the others that you know are doing so well globally. But there are not so good examples of networks and network effects. Increasing concentration, economic power in elites, leading to terrible things. The worst global financial crisis in 60 years, that's an example. And there's lots of serious and long-term problems that are popping up now. There's a global demand problem, a lack of global demand for goods. That's why governments are printing money. They call it helicoptering. Take a helicopter, drop money in every country. Send the helicopter again and drop more money in each country. Somehow, eventually, we'll run out of gas for the helicopter, I guess. You have a permanent group of young people who are jobless or marginally employed, which will not be you by virtue of your commitment to education and the things that you care about. You have a growth in percentage of service sector jobs, and they tend to be in the government or public sector, which are less productive. You have a lack of efficiency in government and public sector jobs due to regulation, union rules, and no tolerance for risks. You have a problem of democracy, that individuals will sometimes vote for their own local interest rather than society's interest. You have a loss of the traditional role of media, and you have the fact that political systems can actually fail. These are very serious, weighty problems. So I look at this and I say, well, what's the upside? We've got lots of capital. We have lots of money floating around this global system. We need economically viable projects in the world. And what are some of the best solutions that we know now? Let me give you an example in education. In STEM education, there are plenty of examples. STEM is basically the math and science stuff. There are plenty of examples of internet-enabled education, right? Universities are now looking at various startups that are doing this. I'm on the board of something called the Khan Academy, which is revolutionizing sort of the way high schools think about how they should teach various classes and so forth. These are all video internet solutions of one kind or another. We want as many of those choices as possible, and we want to measure the hell out of them to see whether they work or not. And there's promising results in each. You have universal language translation. And everybody goes, oh, yeah. Do you have any idea how important that is? People have searched for universal language translation for thousands of years. Wars have been started and fought and lost and won over the fact that people could not communicate. In a few years, we just solved that problem. And no one gives us any credit as computer scientists. Right, Dan? I mean, we've been talking about this. Where are all the awards for the fact that we've now translated everything to everything else, everyone can talk to everybody? I mean, come on, guys. Now, come on, here you are at Cornell, and you know, you've got some loopy professor who's got some assignment in some weird language, just type it into Google. Okay, you're done. Sorry. Sorry, David, I didn't mean that. Well, sort of I did. Let's keep going. I'll give you another example. With modern financial tracking systems, we can develop a global financial asset model where we can actually solve the tracking problem for illicit goods and money. We can actually figure out the source and elements of corruption. And we can fix it and eliminate it, largely. That has more impact on a whole bunch of countries and people than you could possibly imagine. We could establish a principle that you should always have two choices in government services and educate people that, which keeps everybody efficient in one way or the other. There are lots and lots of examples of this. Innovation is disruptive and often occurs from outside of the system. You could build a consensus on how new jobs are created. right? Two-thirds are done from small businesses. Let's celebrate entrepreneurs. Let's figure out, of course, by the way, this is the audience that did this, right? This is the whole initiative around Cornell, is to try to understand entrepreneurship. You have a very successful program here, which I visited this afternoon as an example. It's important to establish a culture of fact. When you see a debate on television about facts, demand a follow-up analysis on the truth. And if they're lying to you, turn off the television. Now, many of you actually don't watch television anymore, which solves that problem, but you get the idea. You can actually know whether things are true or false. You can actually decide if political leaders are misleading you or not. You have an ability to know things that we didn't before. An example, you can think about food distribution in the developing world. The food is stolen and spoiled and so forth. Demand that the ultimate recipient send you an SMS that says, hey, I got the food, and then figure out why it didn't get there. So when I look at it, I look at technology, which is sort of what we all do, and a whole bunch of you do with me, and we say, what can technology help solve? The education problem, the corruption problem in illicit networks, the terrible tyrant problem, the small business growth problem, the language problem, the energy problem, which I haven't talked about, which is amazing, and the bad government problem. Pretty good list, right? Reason to be optimistic. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, political systems, governance systems do matter, but real leadership is very hard to find. And that's why we turn to you, the leaders who will be stepping up into usher some sort of a new, you're going to listen to me and you're going to figure it out. And you'll figure it out better than I will. To me, the question remains, what does the technology future like? And keeping in mind that predictions are a great way to look foolish, it's important to point out that the future will come sooner and be stranger than any of us think right now. Now, everybody here knows that connectivity is changing the world in ways that none of us could possibly imagine. Everyone can dream of a far-off future where everyone is connected, everyone lives longer, and the poor are lifted up and given new voice and new hope. But the truth is, we don't have to dream. The technology that can truly change lives and nations and planets, much of it's already here, or will be very soon. So here's what I predict that all this technology will allow to make happen. It's a future that in some ways is right around the corner, but in other ways is already here. We're going to be more efficient. So you wake up in the morning and imagine a fully integrated living space, no alarm clocks, the coffee is made, your windows open to let in the sunshine, and there's a back massage, not a loud buzz, that nudges you awake. By the way, REM-timed sleep alarms exist already. You've got a mattress sensor monitoring your sleeping rhythm, and it coordinates with your home as to not wake you up and interrupt this cycle. You skim through the daily news on transparent screens, holograms of your email, to decide whether you really have to get up. And of course, then you get into your driverless car. I mean, come on, we let humans drive these things? I mean, the concept of human drivers will be seen as antiquated. You let humans drive things that are 2 tons that can kill people? We can do a better job. Now, I've been in the Google driverless car, and it's hair-raising, trust me. And there's a really big red button that's a stop button. So we're not quite there, but we're getting there. There are plenty of other examples. Voice recognition, instant transcription of emails, texts, no more texting and driving, even though you're likely to won't be driving anyway. Think about social robots. Think about that recognize human gestures and respond to them. Your life is centralized, your small task streamlines, leaving you more time to tackle the big tasks, the deep tasks, letting you get away from work, learn a new language, climb a mountain, meet somebody new, free you up to live your life the way you want in ways that your generation before you could never have done. Pretty neat. That's not the most important story. There's an even more important story in the developing world. 1.5 billion people live on less than a dollar a day, and hundreds of millions of children go to bed hungry at night. Half of the world's people don't even live under democratic governments. The rights that we all enjoy are a rarity, not a norm. And when it comes to the internet, we think everyone is online, but only 1 billion people have smartphones, and 2 billion have access to the web today. So for most of the world, internet cafes are far-off digital oases in technological deserts. But in this century, there's a chance for change on this horizon. Connectivity can revolutionize every aspect of our society, politically, socially, economically. And I would tell you that to connect the world is to free the world. And here's how it can happen. Village fishermen and women can keep fish on the line and wait for calls instead of waiting to bring them onto the market. You can allow formerly isolated people to connect with people in the world, be part of the world, exchange information, learn from, and teach the world. Digital data changes society. Data is a tool. Governments can measure the success of programs. The media can check the government's claims. Markets expand by better metrics, reshaping economies. Newly discovered talents. I mean, perhaps the best graphic designers come from a part of Botswana because of a particular aspect of their culture and their sense of style. And all of a sudden, those become the wealthiest citizens in Botswana because they can practice their work from where they live but serve a global audience. Newly competitive advantages for disadvantaged economies. New opportunities for collaboration, for ways to parents to educate their children. Any child who cannot attend school because it's too far or too dangerous or expensive, now they have a lifeline to this limitless world of learning. But I even don't think that's so impressive, although it's life-changing. Many of our most pressing public and individual health issues, right, some of them anyway, obesity, diabetes, can be brought under control. Now, bear with me. How are you going to do that? The next step of medical technology, medical science, is devices that transdermally, that is, without invading your skin, without pricking your skin, measure what's going on, and ingestible pills. We think of these as microscopic robots that track blood pressure, detect early signs of heart disease or even cancer. You should say, is he making this stuff up? There is already a pill approved by the FDA that collects information for about a patient's response to a drug, relays information to a doctor over a Wi-Fi network, in case you're wondering how important Wi-Fi is. So think about what this means for chronic sufferers and the elderly. Automatic and intensely accurate reminders to take medications, constant digital interaction with your doctor. So when I think about it, what I want is a how's my mom doing app, right? And my mom, by the way, would take the smartphone that I gave her, because you know I'm like her mom, right? Or she's like my mom. And so she's going to basically run this thing, and it'll alert me if there's some significant change in her life patterns. It says, call your mom. See how she's doing. So my point is, you follow that reasoning, each of us has access to our own personal healthcare systems. We can detect if something's wrong with us, find the closest and best-equipped doctor to handle it, and get that doctor all the information that we need before we walk into her or his door. The doctor calls you, not the other way around. You better get your rear end into this hospital right now. Don't ignore this text message. Think about it. So I want to talk a little bit more about the distant future. I've talked about what I think will be true in the next 5 or so years, but I think that we see beginnings of what will happen when you all are 10 years out, 15 years out in your new careers and with the impact that you're going to have. The current structures of the world are going to come under much more pressure. The aging of the Western world, the demographics of smaller families mean that even for the most advanced countries, the only path is rapid improvement in productivity so that the standard of living can be maintained on a per-generational basis. The countries with demographic dividends today will face this in a decade or two. So China, India, those sorts of things. So for the set of things that bind us together, DNA, health, and human spirit, we'll know so much more about ourselves as the global knowledge expands. This unparalleled explosion in simultaneous science means core learning grows faster, not slower. Now, here at a university, you know this. The average person thinks that everything's been discovered is already been discovered. There'll be no new progress. This is manifestly wrong. In fact, global collaboration with universities like this one, with everybody else, mean more and faster innovation, more and faster and exciting new inventions of all kinds. Global science knows no restrictions, and we're all locked into the same physics, regardless of our nationality or sect. What's more is globalization means that thousands of local experiments in each country, of which best practice becomes clear. Do you know those French might actually be useful for something? They might actually have done something better than we did. Shocking. Okay, I'm being facetious, that was a joke. In an age of Twitter, if you tell a joke, you have to label it a joke. Simple rule, easy to remember. Where the problem is lack of awareness and lack of education, these problems are solved in, over the next decade because everyone is now or soon will be connected. So where there's a lot of information, we can solve those problems. If it's healthcare or security or cultural, the problems can persist longer. The sum of rising expectations, comparison of other systems, puts enormous pressure on our existing institutions. These institutions, riddled with tradition, intuition, and special interests, in my view, are going to be overcome by this tsunami of pressure from expectations. By the way, in technology terms, we call this a forced upgrade. Human systems are messy and unpredictable, and the surprises will be causes for disappointment and further conflict. And the autocracies, by the way, will have the toughest time because they're the most change resistant. At least the democracies will do okay. The twin forces of globalization and automation then put enormous pressure on systems and governments. Simply replicating what worked in the past is not going to work in the future. And even after security and basic infrastructure is established, developing countries are going to face very stiff global competition unless they can establish a unique advantage in resources, human capital, natural resources, minerals, oil, and the like. It's interesting that if you try to go even farther, now we're really on thin ice, 20 years, 30 years, you actually conclude, what was surprising to me, eventually technology just disappears. The ultimate achievement, my goal, if you will, is to make technology just disappear. Now, I don't mean technology will become less relevant. I mean it becomes part of everyday life. Now, Arthur C. Clarke once said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. That's true. But I'd argue that any sufficiently widespread technology ceases to be magic, hence my comment earlier about universal translation, or Google Maps, like, oh my God, you know, how do they do this? Oh yeah, I knew that forever. Why are you surprised, you know? So when it's everywhere, it no longer surprises. In the future, people will have to spend less time getting technology to work, worrying which cables work and with computers and where your content is stored. No more ports or prompts or plugins, because it'll all be seamless. It will just be there. In that sense, the web will be everything, and it will be nothing. It will be like electricity. And as for the future of the web, if I had to sum it up in one sentence, it will be nothing, and it will be everything. It'll be nothing because it will disappear, not by going away, but by going everywhere. So if we get this right, I claim, and I want to challenge you, that we can fix all of the world's most pressing problems, to beam light rays of hope, if you will, to millions who up till now have only seen a flicker. We've gotten ourselves into sort of some sort of weird, depressed state about all of this. I think it's wrong. I think it's actually just wrong. And I would argue that each of us, and in particular you, by virtue of the opportunities before you, have that power right in your pockets, right? Literally through these devices, my Android phone, my Nexus S, right? Now here's the deal. If it's true, if what I said is true, we have all this knowledge literally at our fingertips. But just because we know so much more doesn't mean that we mean our problems don't go away, right? The future doesn't just happen, okay? It's not etched or written or coded anywhere. There's no algorithm that says, sorry, there's no formula or algorithm that says technology will do X, so Y is sure to happen. Computers can do amazing things. That's why I do what I do. My colleagues here at the university, this is why we took on the challenge of computing and information technology that we're so proud of. These things in your pockets, they contain power inside of them that your parents would never have possibly imagined. They have speed, they have memory, they have intricately complicated wiring and unfathomably complex circuitry. But I'll tell you this one thing that they actually don't have. They don't have a heart. Interesting. All of these connections that you forge, the digital ties that bind our humanity together, it's not possible without technology. But it's not possible without you, and more importantly, without a heart. You have that heart. You will provide the pulse, if you will, with this technology platform for our future. So to finish up, let me say that I studied this a little bit using my favorite search engine. He's a graduate from this university a little while back, class of 1921, E.B. White, right? And his archives are here on campus, as you all know. And he said, quote, "I arise in the morning torn between the desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." Pretty good quote. What's interesting is if you think about it, this is why this is such a neat quote. You don't have to make that choice anymore. You can do both. I urge you to do both, and I expect you to do both. And frankly, the rest of us need you to do both. So please go ahead and plan your day. Technology can be one of our most potent tools, but it's ultimately the users who change the world. That's you. It's up to you to improve our world, to enjoy our world. And because of you, unlike any generation that has come before, you can do both. Thank you very much.
What a wonderful, uplifting, optimistic speech. And now...
I think we should be optimistic.
We should. Education is inherently the most optimistic imaginable activity. So Eric has agreed to take questions for quite a while, and we have microphones in the aisles down here. And do we have them upstairs? Oh, you'll have to text those messages down then. So please down here line up, or upstairs just stand up in front of the exit areas, and I'm sure we can hear you. And any questions you'd like to ask?
The university, you must have
some
questions.
Yes, sir.
So you mentioned one of the products of the new digital age is the increased concentration of power. And now, obviously, Google has done amazing things, but with all the distribution of information that Google does, how do you see preventing monopolizing sort of information in the future?
I'm sorry, repeat the last part.
So now obviously Google holds a lot of power. It has a lot of technologies that we use in our day-to-day lives. But when companies like this grow too big, how do you prevent like the monopolization of these technologies and the monopolization of information?
Well, hopefully we are respecting your privacy and your judgment, which is why you're coming to Google. Internally, we think of ourselves as 1 foot away from defending you. So if we were to violate your trust, to lie to you or whatever, you go right to our competitor, who happens to be from a bigger company with more resources and a bigger global reach. So ultimately, I think competition plus hopefully our own values is a good check and balance for you. And if we really screwed up, the government would come in and regulate. Hopefully that's not going to happen.
Thank you.
I think, can we turn the volume up on Eric's mic, please?
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Mr. Schmidt. My name is Tara. I'm a student at the School of Hotel Administration. I just wanted to ask you, your speech was very wonderful and optimistic about the benefits of technology, but there have also been cases where technology can cause problems. And I was wondering, in the face of especially problems with hacking, how does Google plan to move forward and make sure that these problems do not become international issues?
I think first place, many people say technology does not have a bias. I believe that technology does have a bias of empowerment of individuals. And I view that as largely a positive bias, and I think most Americans would view that. There are plenty of people in the world who do not. With that empowerment of individuals comes the empowerment of bad people too. And so that's sort of the way that I think about it. And there's an awful lot of people who have a lot of free time to do evil things, maybe because they can't do anything else. You know, maybe nobody else wants to work with them. Maybe there's something screwy with them. We have technology to address most of these issues. So if you look at the duality of privacy and security, I would argue that it's our job to do a good job of security. And the technology we have is based on what are called public key crypto systems, various stored data systems. We can make your information secure, you know, appropriately private and under your control. But you have a responsibility to understand what it is you're doing, to know where you're going, to not completely trust everybody, to pay attention to brands. But I think the reality is that the technology does empower some bad people, as well as this overwhelmingly number of good people.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yes, sir.
I have a question. You know, Google every single day is expanding into new industries and you know, creating new products. What would you say is going to be the next product that Google really releases that is the fastest growing? It can be an existing product, or I guess you can't talk about anything in the future, but.
Well, I can speculate. You know, we've talked a lot about this Google Glass product, which is the glasses, and no one has any idea what people are going to do with this, but there's a sense that having that perspective in life, the perspective that what you see, and then being able to show it straight to you in your vision, is a big game changer. And I talked a little bit earlier about the car. And the car is another example, because it will clearly save lives at some point in a meaningful way. So I think there are plenty of examples that are like that are in the pipeline. Often we do things you don't really understand what level of impact they're going to have, but they're interesting or they're new. And we'll see.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Michael Poo from the Arts and Sciences School and the Johnson School. So my question is, there are all those different sources of data that's being used, possibly analyzed. How is it normalized, all those different sources of data, and if there will be an integration with, let's say, Open Graph data?
Yeah, we, first place, are you heard about the Facebook Open Graph or a different one? That would require some changes in Facebook's willingness to work with us. If you get my drift. So the general, first place, our job is to rank. And so we have to take a million pieces of information and order them from 1 to N. We understand ranking like things pretty well. We do that with various sophisticated algorithms, web links, that sort of thing. And that's been the nature of our success so far. Over the last few years, we've done ranking between types. So we'll add video, or we'll add audio, or what have you. And those are the best approximation we can come up with of how you would rank a video with some text and so forth, and we normalize it that way.
I see.
And we would see our mission as making that better and better and better. It's our best current guess, algorithmically, at how you would mix everything.
So in the Google Analytics service, right, do you think you'll be providing, let's say, gender or age data?
I see what you're saying. We've discussed that. We have to be very careful to respect people's privacy. And so we want to stay well on the side of respecting your privacy and not collecting too much of that information.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hi. My name is Edward Chang, and I'm an architecture student. First of all, I have a comment, is that your vision of the future is amazing, but it eerily reminds me of the fat people that live on spaceships in the movie WALL-E, in which technology has completely encompassed their lives, and I don't know if that's really a good thing.
I didn't say anything about obesity, except we were going to cure it. So we're very clear as to my position as obesity. I'm opposed to it,
okay.
Right? I want to cure it. It's bad for your health, right?
Okay, all right. My first question is, Google's, I guess, informal motto is don't be evil.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what that really means and what steps Google has taken to not be evil. My second question is, all this technology, the way I see it as an architecture student is that it seems like the virtual realm has sort of invaded the physical realm in a way, in which what I see in the past couple decades, is that there's so much emphasis on innovation in the virtual technology space, but not really in the physical space. There's these news stories about how people don't make things anymore. What happens is that people start just make software on computer displays.
And I actually disagree with that, so let me see if I can answer both.
Okay.
On the question of don't be evil is really a cultural value, that when you see something you don't like, call it out and say, maybe we should think about doing this before we actually do it. So think of it not as a rule book, you know, evil and not evil. Think of it rather as permission to speak up and say, that doesn't feel right. I When I first joined the company in 2001, I thought it was a joke. And normal company, right? I'm sitting there at the table a few months in, and we have a bunch of engineers, and there's a complex debate involving advertising system and its use in search. And one of the engineers says, "That's evil." And it was like, you know, the room had a bomb go off, right? And everybody stopped, and then they had this debate, which I found fascinating, for 30 minutes, and they could not agree. So they stopped the project at that moment until there was further discussion about this. So it's real, right? And it worked, I think, to the benefit of our users and to Google. On the question of the physical stuff, the biggest, I didn't talk about this in my talk, but there's a huge explosion in 3D printing. And the evidence is that, in fact, people will make lots of things, but they'll make them in different ways. And that there will be some local printer that where you can design your virtual object or eventually houses and buildings, and you'll press a button, and all the pieces will get assembled down the street to your spec efficiently with great strength and so forth at a price which is largely competitive with volume manufacturing. That's why it's so interesting. And that's a technological revolution which deserves its own talk and is amazing. Okay. So, as an example, you're an architecture student. I have a number of friends who are architects who build their little models using these 3D printers, and they just make the whole model, and then somebody assembles it for them. I said, that's not fun. You didn't spend, 20 hours reassembling your model. You just had us print it. And they said, what's wrong with this? It's efficiency. So.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
I largely agree with your vision, but I have two quick comment questions. One is, it's been said that great art and great music is often a result of limitations, of restricted capabilities of the current technology. So by making the technology so all-encompassing, are we not doing mediocre, but doing very good, but being an impediment to great? And a related question is, cultures tend to have a common body of knowledge and things that we had to struggle in school to memorize and things of this sort. I think this technology vision might be decreasing or limiting the common body of knowledge of a particular culture. And that cultural common body of knowledge is often a binder to cause great collaborations. What are your thoughts?
With respect, I don't agree with anything you said.
I'm sure you don't.
So I might as well just say it.
Yes.
So with respect to art, we all mythologize the starving artist who, had all these terrible things happen to them.
No, I was more like the nature of the instrument, the problem with paints. I don't like artists to struggle, but the thought is, you can make anything with electronic sounds now. Do you know of any great electronic music to compare with Bach, who had the troubles with how do you play an open G trumpet, things of this sort?
Okay. I think most people would agree that Bach's talents were intrinsic to somebody once in 1,000 years, as opposed to the fact that he had some specific limitation in his instrument. But we could debate that. I think the fact of the matter is that more people have access to culture and tools, so therefore more people have a shot at greatness. That's got to net produce greater artists, greater body of work. You and I may not like what they produce, but the fact of the matter is they have more opportunities to find an audience, to follow their passion, and to be appropriately tortured.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
With the coming of the information age, I feel like less value is being placed on the information that we're now connected to. So journalists, authors, musicians, and maybe now educators are finding more people expecting their content to be free, while the people who distribute the content, like Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, are making billions of dollars. Do you expect this trend to continue in the future, or how do you see the liberal arts regaining value in the future?
Well, another way of phrasing your question is that one of the things that's happened with digital technology and the internet is that the distribution costs of things are free, and the copying costs are free. So that's changed us from an economics of scarcity to an economics of abundance. There are plenty of examples of new startups that are making plenty of money on, for example, YouTube with advertising using new content formats. It's harder for the incumbents who made models by restricting access. You know, you can't see it and so forth. So I would argue that there will be plenty of money in the future for this, and the majority of the money will be made by the content people and their partners and their studios, as opposed to the distribution companies like Google, precisely because that's the right structure. But it requires the adoption of a new monetization model, right? And that's indeed what's occurring. It just takes a while.
Hey, Eric. My name is Paul. You just mentioned that whether Facebook would like to work with us, and that's just completely interest. You know, that just interests me so much. So I worked at both companies before. You know, food are great. Google's food is a little bit better. But you know, because Facebook recently just introduced, you know, the search based on personal information. I think they just mentioned that, and then the stock price, you know, increased. And, you know, I love both companies, and I would really like to see technologies from both companies merge and, you know, make our life, future life better. I just want to, you know your thoughts on this and, you know.
I agree, and I've had many conversations with our friends at Facebook. We sent quite a few of our executives over there. So we know each other. We know each other extremely well. We socialize and so forth. But we've not been able to come up with a business structure that everybody's happy with. So maybe in the future, you never know. It's a small world, there's lots of ways in which customers can put pressure to open things up. So, you know, for example, most of Facebook's information is generally not available, not searchable, right? That's a problem because the world should be open and searchable in our view, and they may disagree.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
My name is Graham Harwood. I'm from the College of Engineering. It's been said that any significantly disruptive technology cannot come from an established source, and that can also be said for social change as well. And in some senses, Google has become an established source as well as democracy as an established form of government. So how can both a company like Google or a government like democracy affect in disruptive change, at least in the sense that we have governments that are considered democratic but have significant amounts of corruption, and Google, we'd like to see new technologies from you, but it's hard to see how a disruptive technology can come from a company that's so established.
I think that if what you said is generally true, and it's very hard for larger institutions to innovate and reform. Today in our industry, we have at least four companies that are driving change at a historic rate: Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. Each of whom has huge innovation engines that we all benefit. And we benefit from the competition and the fighting and prices falling and so forth. So there's a counterexample to your point. For political systems and democracies, it's much harder because political systems, once stabilized, are very hard to reform internally. They tend to change from an external shock. Right? Otherwise, there's too many vested interests that continue it. So my question, which I would ask you, is, how bad does the political system in the United States have to get before the citizens actually focus on real change? And let me remind you that our political leaders, who we seem to decry at great length, somebody voted for them. In fact, the majority of us voted for them because we're certainly a functioning democracy. So the challenge, I would say, in a democracy, in dictatorships it's another matter, but in a dictatorship, sorry, in a democracy, you get the government you elect. If you don't like it, get a different one. And that's, I think, how change really happens. It happens at the ballot box.
Well, I want to take this occasion to thank Eric Schmidt one more time for being our 2012 Hatfield Lecturer. Thanks, everyone.